Okay, folks, let's get started. So good morning or good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this, the May 4th, 2010 Wikibon Peer Insight Research Meeting, where peers discuss challenging problems in the data center. I am your host and moderator, Dave Vellante, and the topic for today is disaster recovery, achieving zero data loss using asynchronous infrastructure. We are very pleased today to welcome two IT practitioners from large financial institutions, one based in the U.S. and the other in Europe, although I believe actually they're both physically in the U.S. today. Each individual has extensive experience with disaster recovery and business continuity and IT solutions, and they are going to remain anonymous today, so we will refer to them as Hilton and Steve. And we are also joined by Dr. Alex Winokur, who is the CTO of Exana. So Hilton and Steve and Alex, welcome.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you for joining us today. Hilton and Steve, can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear.
Great. Yep, absolutely. Just some quick housekeeping, if I may. I'd like to ask again, if you're not speaking on the call, please mute your line. And if your phone doesn't have a mute, you can hit star 6 to mute and star 6 to unmute if you wish to participate, which everyone is welcome to do, and we encourage you to do so. As you probably heard, this call is being recorded and it will last 1 hour. If you want to tweet this call, please use the #Wikibon hashtag so it's going to feed to our social media outlets. And then let me just set up the call. So disaster recovery planning, as you know, involves a complex series of trade-offs. And these relate to things like RPO and RTO and distance, geography, business value, latency, application interdependencies, threat levels. And there are a number of organizational and technology integration and asset management challenges that practitioners need to contend with when architecting a disaster recovery solution. And more specifically, when the goal is zero data loss, the challenges become even more pressing. Technologies are just becoming available to better address these challenges, and we're seeing the potential to mitigate risks with less complex infrastructure and possibly even more effective infrastructure, and that's what we'd like to talk to today. So the agenda really is around zero data loss. When is it important? From a business planning standpoint, how do you guys go about understanding the requirements? What are the considerations of zero data loss from several perspectives, organizational, technical, testing, et cetera? And then we want to talk about the technology of zero data loss and how it can be achieved. So again, welcome to Hilton and Steve and Alex, and thanks for joining us today. So Hilton, I'd like to start with you if I can. First of all, could you just tell us a little bit about your areas of expertise? And then something really basic. When we say zero data loss, what are we talking about?
Sure. So my main area of expertise is in the storage space. And having managed enterprise storage space for the last 8 years and now focusing on looking ahead at emerging technologies, I've been within the firm since 2001 when we first started looking at using the storage backend as the means for protecting our data. Prior to that, we used other application means and point solutions for data protection. We decided to approach it from a holistic view and use a technology in the back end to replicate that data synchronously. At that time, we viewed it as, given the time frame 2001, we viewed it as important to have absolute data protection. We were willing to take the hit on performance. Resiliency was of the highest importance, and also we even then realized there was a complexity as soon as we introduced an asynchronous structure where we'd have to have a good understanding of the consistency of the various data points across the application stack, and we really saw that was a complexity. So at the time we adopted a pure sync standpoint for a certain tier of our storage, and another tier of storage, which was defined as a lower tier, its property was no replication whatsoever. So we basically provided a Boolean choice to our customers around that, which was a starting point for us. And as the years have gone by, we've had to add new features and sets to that, but ultimately there's still that complexity with asynchronous and that guaranteed data loss that comes with it. And to be honest, we're still investigating that to this day and building up our knowledge base and looking for solutions to ease that complexity.
Okay, great. Hello, Steve. Maybe you could do the same. Just give us a little bit about your expertise without divulging your firm, and then you can sort of as well address, you know, zero data loss and what's important about it, and maybe how you determine about where to apply zero data loss solutions.
Okay, well, I should probably start by saying that as a sort of head of IT, CIO, my area of expertise may not be anything specific. It's a bit more broad than that. If it is anything that's an area of expertise, it's trying to read between the lines of what some of the people in our business say and turning that into something we can execute. Now, in a couple of companies I've worked at, we've been operating on a zero data loss basis since the 90s. And in all instances, it's really come from the same simple fact for me. No matter how often I talk to people in the business about what level of data loss they can tolerate, what their recovery point and recovery time should be, it's always at odds with any experience I've had in a genuine recovery, and in fact in any test. Quite often you're speaking to one or two representatives, the message doesn't always filter down as clearly and exactly as it should to some of the business practitioners, and they find that decisions that have been made on their behalf are less practical in reality than anybody ever anticipated. So I took a rather broad brush approach to this and said, well, the obvious answer is lose nothing, recover everything, and then surely there can be no complaint other than one of cost potentially. And of course, a number of the, if you like, the conflicts or the compromises you may have to make that you mentioned in your introduction. So for me, it was a very, very simple decision. If I choose to have zero data loss, I'm never left with any level of exposure at the point I have to recover, other than one I've clearly understood about distance and day-to-day operational performance. And if those things have been accepted on a day-to-day basis, at the point I need to recover, I'm not faced with an ugly picture. So it wasn't an IT take on the issue at all. It was more a human one, recognizing that what people ask for one day and what they actually need when under pressure can be quite different.
So how do you squint through the sort of emotional desire or conveyance of, hey, we need zero data loss, of course, to the real business need? Can you talk about that process a little bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, what we've seen over time is the business need tends to try to be justified purely on cost. And quite often I find it quite difficult to judge the true cost of some of the loss of data. You start ending up with all kinds of curious calculations drawn into the mix of soft costs, opportunity costs, the amount of extra and repeated effort. And you end up, in my opinion, saying that what we have here is something that isn't a science at all. Understanding people's desire is quite simple. That's very easy for them to enunciate. I don't want to lose any of my data ever. And if that's affordable, and that fits within an IT budget that between myself and the CFOs we can agree, I didn't feel I needed to go much further than that. It was, we can do this at reasonable cost. Here are the compromises. And over time, we've seen regulation drive a greater need for zero data loss. We've seen some relatively ugly incidents in the world that have exposed people to data loss, and then they begin to think about it harder. So in essence, it was, let's start from a philosophical standpoint of, we want to be able to recover everything. We want that recovery to be remarkably easy, incredibly reliable, and very, very fast. And we can gain all of that out of one. So I figured that simple approach was the best way to do it. And over time, I mean, I wouldn't say that over time it's proven to be right. That would be rather arrogant. But what we have seen is an increasing level of regulation and an increasing awareness from people of the difficulty of recovering from multiple recovery points. So it's generally been accepted that there may be a price to pay for this. It's simple, fast, and reliable. It might be the best thing to do. But, you know, as with everyone, I'm always under pressure to attempt to reduce the cost somewhat, and if I could achieve the same objective at a lower cost, it's an absolute no-brainer for me. I would do it.
Okay, so before we go there, and I want to come back to that last point you made, I mean, it sounds like you're saying, look, our instincts tell us that we have applications that require zero data loss. We don't need some kind of fancy calculations to demonstrate that, and if we can justify that with the CFO, then we go for it. And then maybe it's on a relative basis with your application portfolio. Hilton, is that sort of the same based on your experience? And it doesn't have to necessarily even be your organization. It could be other organizations that you interact with or others that you've worked with.
Sure. Now, what Steve says there resonates with me. I mean, the other point, which is good to hammer home, is that essentially, it depends when the event occurs, right? So, and quantifying it, that makes quantifying it impossible. If you do have an outage or some other, you know, power outage or the like on a Saturday night, depending on your business, that may be a recoverable event and you have the time to get things back and up and running before you get to the time when your business needs the services. However, if it happens in the middle of a business day, that's a different sensation altogether, and the value of having zero data loss or being able to quickly get your business up and running again is of paramount importance. So I think, again, that putting, and we've all battled with this over the years, trying to put that dollar value on that being able to get the RTO and RPO down, and, you know, the more money you throw at it, the better things get, but, you know, there's other drawbacks as well around latency and the like, and that ultimately ends up becoming an optimization issue you arrive at with your business. And so we've worked at that, but again, it's never been a perfect marriage, and it kind of moves back and forth depending on how the levers are pulled throughout the industry and within the firm. And I'd say that we've spent a lot of time focusing on the recovery portion and doing tests and stuff, but as Steve already mentioned, a lot of the tests are you know, perfect situation lab test environments, and often are very different from the real world scenarios that we've run into. You know, and that's where it comes down to the fact that we just know that if that data is at another site, if you have all the data, you're already one step ahead. If you do not have all the data and you have lost data, there's an additional step in the recovery, and there's also that sense of understanding what the impact of that data loss is, which, depending on the application, depending on the business service, is very different across the broad spectrum of products within our firm.
So I think people can, you know, conceptualize that different applications have different business value. How do you address things like interdependencies across the application portfolio? Is that of increasing importance, or am I overstating that?
It's certainly of increasing importance, especially as we move towards more of a virtual environment and are looking at things like private clouds. Having said that, the asynchronous replication, by its very nature, means you need to have a high-level understanding of how the application, the stack is tied together, because you have to maintain that consistency, or may have to maintain that consistency across that stack. On the other hand, with if you do have the data at the other side, you're at a point in time where everything was in sync. There's still an element there around being able to tie it together to bring things up in a correct, orderly fashion. For instance, you might have more business-critical apps and a framework around bringing those up first, and there's an interrelation between them. So no matter what, you do want to end up being able to tie this all together and be able to orchestrate it well. I'd say that becoming more and more important as we create more and more layers of abstraction, as we've already done with storage, but now at the server and network layer.
It's Josh.
Hi,
now, a synchronous remote copy from the nature is keeping data consistency, because it is sending groups, and the groups are normally finished. Synchronous remote copy is not keeping data consistency. Now, and this is the whole issue. If you want to recover fast, it's not important if you lost the modification. It is important to have consistent data. To have consistent data, you have to use consistency group. And by high-end systems, you have consistency group even spanning different systems. And to the question which was how you make it depends on application, if it is single application, every volume, which depends to this application you combine in consistency group. For example, the database, the logs, alternate logs, all of them will be one consistency group, which means that the remote copy, the synchronous remote copy, will freeze any update with any error on this group. Now, if you have application which depend on each other, you have to combine them also in the same group. This is the whole idea. When the vendors came initially with disaster recovery, when IBM announced the PPRC and EMC, the SRDFS, they used something which is called critical equal yes or no, and EMC was the domino effect, and which was freezing everything in case of any error, which didn't work because any false error, everything was closed. And only later on, they developed commands like in IBM, run freeze commands, which other vendor accepted, and consistency groups.
Okay, so I want to, so maybe a good time, and Josh, I'd like to actually come back to you and ask you this question as well, but so it's probably time to bring in Dr. Winokur. Alex Winokur is an expert in the field of data management, data protection, and storage. For those of you who don't know Alex, he spent 11 years within IBM Research, and he achieved the title of Master Inventor. As you know, they just don't hand those things out. He holds a number of patents, or has authored or co-authored a number of patents, probably over 15 by my recollection. And he's a bit of a serial entrepreneur. He was the CTO of XIV. He founded Cepiton and was a co-founder of Axana. So, Alex Winokur, good afternoon, and thanks for being with us today.
Good afternoon, Dave.
So I wonder, can we add some color for the audience? Is just, can we talk a little bit about how organizations typically achieve zero data loss? And then I want to talk about your idea.
Right, so typically to achieve zero data loss, you do synchronous replication for, of course, that goes for relatively limited distances. And if you want to extend the distance, then you do something which is called either a start topology or multi-hop topology, where you have a synchronous replication to another nearby site, and then an asynchronous replication to the remote site, with the assumption that if your primary site goes down, you can synchronize from your secondary close by site the remote site and bring it up to date. Those are the only known ways today to achieve zero data loss.
So it's actually talking about a combination of a synchronous and an asynchronous infrastructure that can accommodate a loss or data loss or a failure or an event and allow you to, at least in theory, recover with zero data loss, correct?
All right.
Okay. Well, so it sounds expensive and complicated. It probably is. Anybody else have any comments there? Josh, anything you'd add? I mean, it sounds pretty straightforward.
I mean, the question is really, what do you want to achieve? If I look in Europe, for example, most of the disaster recovery are in the region. And, okay, the nature is less violent in Europe. So, and most of them are synchronous. Okay. Now, what Alex said about the tree site, it is, I will say, fashion in particular by finance institutes in United States. When you have two configurations or two possibilities of tree size, it can be cascading, all connected to once IBM EMC called STAR. Now, so, and this is the first one is protecting against local disasters. Or the synchronous remote copy is keeping the data loss at minimum and protecting you against local disasters. The asynchronous remote copy is protecting you against what is called global disasters. When global disaster doesn't have to be global. It can be loss of power in the region, as you have, for example, in North America, power failure a couple of years ago, or tornado or things like this. And this is normally the third data center is a distance of 200 kilometer plus.
Okay, so you got a situation where it's synchronous, maybe you pay a performance penalty, but you get that no data loss within that metro region. Would you say it was, Josh, a couple hundred kilometers and probably ideally less, right?
Yeah, okay. It's the different other issues. I wrote several research when I was in Gartner about different myths in the remote copy.
Yeah.
The thing is also, don't emphasize the loss of performance so much with synchronous remote copy. The thing is that the synchronous remote copy was tested up to 300 kilometers.
Okay.
Now, the latency loss is about 1 millisecond per 100 kilometers. As I mentioned before, most of the synchronous remote copy, very simply because of the cost of the infrastructure, are much smaller distance. Which now you have to understand also, synchronous remote copy, the required bandwidth have to be peak plus, above the peak data transfer plus. Asynchronous remote copy, the bandwidth is the average data transfer. So the infrastructure of synchronous remote copy is much more expensive than asynchronous remote copy. And this is also one of the reasons that the distances, the practical distances, are much smaller. I don't know, in fact, anyone more than 40 kilometers. I assume that exists, but I don't know any installation which is more than 40 kilometers, despite that they can be up to 300 kilometers.
Okay, yeah, thank you. So you're saying one of as much a practical nature of anything just due to cost. So, okay, so we have the situation where you have synchronous and then you've got another infrastructure, another data center, which is asynchronous to protect you against some kind of local disaster. So, Alex, I'd like to bring you back into the conversation and then get the practitioner's reaction. So you basically had this idea to use an airplane black box metaphor, if I can say that, to harden a local or the proximate synchronous infrastructure and then utilize your asynchronous infrastructure in a manner that attains zero data loss. Can you describe your idea and maybe talk a little bit about how that's come to fruition?
Okay, so indeed, the idea is to put next to the primary storage a black box like the one in the airplanes, which basically can survive mischiefs similar to those that occur when an airplane crashes, and store in that black box basically all the transactions which were not yet transmitted to the remote site. Actually, it's a cyclical buffer on a flash drive within a fire protection box, which is also shock protected, crash protected, water protected, and almost any other disaster scenario that you can think of protected. And it cyclically stores that data which has not yet moved to the remote site using asynchronous mirror. In a case of a disaster, then you are left with a remote site which some data is missing there, consistent data but missing data, plus some data in the black box that if you would have applied it to the remote site, you would achieve RPO zero, basically found yourself in a no loss of data situation. The challenge is to bring the data to the remote site, and there are various methods depending on the severity of the disaster. The easiest one is basically to connect with a laptop to the black box, to a fire-protected port, get the data to a laptop, move it outside the disaster zone and transmit it any way you would like to the remote site. And the most sophisticated method is using cellular technology, which is in the black box itself, battery powered, and moving the data through cellular to the remote site. And one of the reasons that we didn't do it, I thought about that idea a long time ago, but it couldn't have been implemented long time ago, is because of the advances of the cellular networks that are happening today and the ability to do it. The bandwidth that was needed for that was not there 2 years ago. So basically, at the recovery after a disaster, you can move the data out of the black box to the remote site, to a server that we are having there that checks the consistency of the data, timestamp, sequence numbers, all the known methods, and applies that to the remote storage, bringing them up to date.
Okay, so basically using the black box as a buffer and then being able to coordinate or synchronize with the asynchronous data. So pretty clever. I presume this is a less expensive approach. I'd like to hear from the practitioners, Hilton and Steve. So what kind of problems would this solve for you? Can you maybe weigh in on that a little bit? Maybe start with Hilton.
Sure. So it solves that point in time issue for us at the very least. It also solves a more subtle issue, which is, if there's a disaster, do you or do you not have your data? There's a regulatory requirement around some of the data to say that you do have it or that it is protected. And I think Exana, and we're still down the road of investigating this with various regulatory organizations, is to understand exactly how protected are we using this type of solution. Because even if, on the disaster side, if it hasn't finished pushing it over the various mediums to that side, there is the possibility, and almost certain possibility, that there is a black box that can be recovered. There's still a little bit of a question then around time to recover the data, and that's where we're still investigating. But it is an interesting side that you do have the potential of not losing the data, even if there is such an event that the copying mechanisms aren't even possible.
Okay. Steve, any thoughts? Could you add anything to that? Or?
Yeah, and this will probably just go to prove that I'm always thinking at a tangent rather than in the line I'm supposed to be thinking in. When we look at our recovery time and our recovery point objective, we're always looking at trying to get this thing up incredibly fast. The problem this would solve for me, I wouldn't pretend to have had a huge experience of disasters. I've been too close to one or two to feel good about, but what I do know about them is no matter how fast you want to recover and how fast you want to restore your business, people don't react in that time frame in the midst of a disaster. So what I've been able to, when I look at this sort of option, it's if I can guarantee zero data loss, I can now move my secondary data center or my backup data center much further away than I otherwise would and guarantee more protection, knowing full well that regardless of how fast IT recover systems, people have an element of recovery time which is different. They need longer. They have to get over the shock. They have to get over the incident. They have to make alternative arrangements, even if they weren't there when it happened. They do have to adjust for the fact that they're going to work to somewhere at some different location, or there's been some other degree of, if you like, unsettlement in their life that doesn't allow them to react instantly. So when I look at this type of product, it allows me to say I can guarantee no data loss, and I can still recover in a time that's quite acceptable, more than quite acceptable, and allow people more time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so you're saying the actually using the practical reality that during a disaster people, like say, need more time, they're frazzled, they've got other things going on, and you can actually use that to improve the infrastructure by, you're saying, putting the asynchronous infrastructure perhaps even further away, buying yourself a little bit more time, which your premise is you have anyway, and then that ensures that zero data loss.
This is David. Sorry, can I just add one extra thing in this, which I think reflects on what was being said just then. In this structure, it seems to be one of the difficulties of these disaster recovery topologies is that testing is incredibly difficult. What struck me about the sort of topologies, simpler topologies that you can have with the asynchronous Xana-type solutions is that testing is much, much simpler. And with better testing, then the chances that the people will react in a better way go up significantly. Would you agree with that, the practitioners?
Yeah, I think I would. I think you mentioned earlier that many of our tests are sort of a somewhat artificial scenario. And this would allow us, I think this would actually allow us to test on a far more realistic basis and develop more comfort. Saying to people, I'm not trying to set something that happens in a test scenario instantly and now you all have to scramble like mad and try and think on your feet. What they would actually test is, you know what, guys, in about an hour or so, I want you to carry on work from somewhere else. See you later. And do that with a sense of calm and a rational approach to it.
I will put it simple. If I will compare synchronous and asynchronous remote copy, synchronous remote, the first thing is there is no single technique. Doesn't matter if it is GDPS or non-stop of HP, there is no single technique that you will not lose at least the last modification. But anyhow, the advantage of synchronous is that you have shorter RPO. The main disadvantage are cost and the complexity of building consistency group and keeping consistency group. Asynchronous remote copy is building the groups. However, the RPO is longer. So if I will look at Xana, what Xana is doing is taking the asynchronous remote copy and allowing you to extend the RPO at lower cost.
Okay.
This is
John MacArthur, by the way.
The other thing that I have heard from some of the practitioners that I've talked to is that if you can protect all of the data for all of the applications and do asynchronous copy over long distance, then you don't have to worry as much about about maintaining the consistency groups because you have protected all of the data. What I hear from some companies is that applications that used to not be in the critical path are now in the critical path, and the business continuity planners aren't necessarily notified about that. Can either of the practitioners comment on that?
Well, I certainly think for me, as somebody who's not the technician, it would be wrong for me to try and answer that one. I'd have to defer to somebody with far greater technical expertise on the groups I have.
Yeah, I think it's not a simple answer. It all depends on what you're trying to protect and what that delivers. Because that pushing to longer distances, having that that layer of protection.
And I got a big crowd going once a day.
So I think it's just a it all depends if depends on the application structure and on the business. The business above you actually sets that requirement, right, which you drive down, and trying to provide that information, I think, is the tough part.
I wanted to open it up a bit, see if there's anybody else who had any questions. Just give you an opportunity to ask the practitioners or Alex Winicore.
Yeah, this is Dave. This is Mike Versace, and that's great discussion so far. I'd like to maybe take the discussion in a bit of a different direction, but still focused on technologies for achieving RPO zero or zero data loss. You know, one of the technologies that we're hearing a lot about now I'll just call them IDA-based technologies, so information dispersal algorithm-based technologies. And these technologies, for those that aren't following it, these technologies basically split data into a number of pieces and allow for the data to be recovered from some threshold number of pieces or nodes. So it's really sort of spreading the risk of data loss out over a number of nodes such that if at least 10 of, say, 15 nodes are available, all of the data is recoverable. And I'm wondering if, Alex, if you have some perspectives on these technologies and how these might be benefit or maybe have certain cost structures associated with them, where what I would define as electronic data recording technologies, which is what we've been talking about to this point, may not. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. So yes, those are new technologies, and you know, I haven't seen enough experience with them, so it's difficult for me to comment. I just, from the technical perspective, make one observation. In this technology, the origin of the update is from a single location.
Correct.
And that single location has to distribute the data to other locations, pieces of the data to based on some algorithms to a lot of other locations. So again, if a disaster occurs at the primary site and it's a disaster that spreads, that its parameters is more than the local nodes and only the remote nodes remain, so all the remote nodes are not going to be updated, obviously, because the single source is the one who is updating them. So the odds of losing data in case of a disaster are about, I can't calculate, but they are, I mean, the probability is pretty high that you would lose in the same case that you would lose in a multi-hop situation, for example.
Go ahead.
Yes, because the source is a single source and it fails. So either it's able, it's a probability issue. And again, if it's a regional disaster, then the odds are relatively low that it will be able to update the more remote nodes.
Yeah, very good. Thanks for making that distinction. That makes it clearer for me. So the I think what you're saying here with electronic data recording is that the risk of data loss with the sort of the local cached black box content, the risk of loss there might be lower just because that data has a specific set of protections built around it. That's very good. Thank you for that explanation.
I'd like to add one point on that. That's assuming that there's a single host that can read and write, but if the architecture in IDA model is allows for distributed readers and writers, you could have separate storage nodes going down and still have access to the data, as long as the threshold number of nodes were still up.
Well, For even if you have multiple readers and writers, then some particular transaction occurs at one of those writers. And if it fails, that transaction is not going to be propagated to the remote nodes. Other transactions will, but this one will not. You are not, I haven't seen an architecture when the same transaction occurs in parallel from a number of nodes in a synchronized way.
One of the things that I hear a lot about is link failures. Either Alex or either of the practitioners comment about the impact of link failures on disaster recovery planning or when you declare disasters and how you recover from disasters?
When you're mentioning links, are you talking about those that are handling the data copying and data replication activity?
Yeah,
I think if you're looking, typically if you're looking at the synchronous type copy, as was mentioned earlier, those links tend to be relatively short. The sheer cost of providing those over long distances becomes quite prohibitive. I mean, disregarding any performance issue, which I've never seen to be particularly great, it's the cost of extending the length of those links, because they are fairly broad links. And we tend to buy them either as dedicated private links. Well, they are private links. They're not switched or routed through anyone's network. They may be dark fiber or a whole dedicated route end-to-end. And we'll also buy them with an alternate and a backup because, that's, again, you're adding to your cost, but you're adding to your guarantee. So diversely routed with an alternate link. I think it depends greatly where you are, quality of your telcos, quality of the geography where the links are actually run. I actually operate I operate in the City of London. If there's anything I do know about London, it doesn't matter where I run a link, there'll be somebody willing to dig up a road. I show absolutely no respect whatsoever for my link whilst they're digging the road. There's a bit of interest at play here. But I haven't found I've been entirely disabled at any point. Because we're only going to one other fixed location, it's relatively close by in geographical terms. The amount of diversity one can put into the link is limited by the distance. So we tend to know where our links go, the exact route, but they are diverse enough, and it's very rare. I can't think of a single occasion in 12 years where I've lost two simultaneously. But that's not to say that it couldn't happen, of course.
A good plan is to plan a main route and alternate route. Well, from practice, the main route is about 20 to 50% longer than the air distance, and the alternate route is 50 to 100% longer than the air distance. But this, normally to my customers, I recommend to make two routes for fiber channels.
And that's what we would do, two routes, as diverse as possible. And I think if we were to do it, when we've done an analysis of the exact route, one route does appear to be about twice as far as the other. If you took the length of cable rather than the A and the B end.
Now, as I mentioned before, the latency on the fibers itself is pretty low. It's 1 millisecond per 100 kilometer. Now, you have also to consider the latency in the control units, because there is a latency in the control unit, there is a latency in the switch, latency in the line, and you have exactly the same on the way back, because the secondary control unit will commit that the data is stored there. So on short distance, in fact, the line latency is negligible, and the latency is of the control units and the switch, and it is in the area of between 1 to 2 milliseconds.
Yeah, I'd absolutely agree with that. In fact, we've done analysis of, these aren't necessarily data links or data replication, but these are for long distance working. And the joke within our IT department is, with a quarter of an inch within a router, has a longer delay than 4,000 miles across the Atlantic.
Yeah.
Is Floyer still on the call, David Floyer?
It's not far off.
Yes, he is. I was smiling at that very, very perceptive comment then.
That's good. Hey, I wonder if you could help us sort of understand from a financial standpoint what this all means. Can you just sort of wrap it out?
Sure. One of the biggest costs of this infrastructure, I think it was mentioned before, always when you do the costing of this, is the lines. Synchronous lines are closer, but have to be at a higher level. The asynchronous lines can be cheaper. They don't have to go for the peak, which is very important. But as you go for longer distances, they become very, very significant. So one of the trade-offs that I encourage people strongly to make is, what is the real benefit that you're getting from going very long distances? Obviously, you get some in terms of political protection, but the further you go, the greater the cost, and the greater the other issues about recovery in terms of people the other end and just the total distance. So from a practical point of view, the costing of pushing things further away may give an illusion of greater protection, which when you do the sums and when you do the analysis of the probability of all of the different components that can go wrong are not justified. One of the ways that I found the most effective in terms of putting those probabilities on all the different things is to go to insurance companies and go to your insurance company and use their figures as the sum of the probabilities, because they have more experience in this area than IT practitioners.
So are you saying that you're talking about this type of solution providing substantial savings on the bandwidth costs, or not so much?
Sure. In terms of a three, the only other way of getting the combination of zero data loss and longer distance is a synchronous solution. A three-point solution, as was described earlier. Against those two solutions, this is a far, far cheaper solution, from a communication point of view. I'm saying that the major cost of that solution is the distance, is the telecommunication path over distance. By making it, 100, 200 miles, that will cut down the cost very significantly of the solution. And I would, suggest that those usually will be sufficiently long distances to give almost all of the distance benefits that you're going to get.
Yeah, I think if I picked up on something you speak about, there was a piece that was, it's very easy for us to get sort of slip into a train of thought that says, the opposite side of the world must be the ultimate level of protection I can get. But it then becomes hugely impractical, and you begin to realize that its impracticality alone says that you've been offered no protection.
Exactly.
In the type of distances which are sensible and logical. So that you can turn around and say, so I do have a recovery point, I have a recovery location. I may have a necessity to get people there at some stage, depending on the nature of the disaster, how far people are willing to go and for how long they're willing to go there. can be quite variable. The only example I've got of that was a very, very practical one. I'd been involved many years ago in a disaster down in Florida from Hurricane Andrew. And the recovery center, I mean, this was good old-fashioned, back it up to tape, ship them off-site, restore them elsewhere. The recovery center was up in Seattle. It was quite difficult to tell a bunch of guys from Miami that, given that everywhere they lived and everything they owned had been destroyed, that the great thing to do was say goodbye to the wife and kids and hop off up to Seattle for a couple of weeks in order to keep this business running. Everyone was quite prepared to hang around and do what it took locally. Very few people were very willing to get on that plane and abandon their family in that circumstance. So I think you do have to consider, how far will people go to leave behind what really matters to them, which for most of us is our friends and family, as important as our job and our employer may be. You don't want to put people in a position where the decision they make is the one you don't want them making. And, you know, maybe 100 miles or so sounds reasonable. You can take the family. It's not impossible. You can get home very, very regularly. It's not too onerous. So short but safe distances probably offer more protection than great distance.
I couldn't agree more.
It's Josh, as I mentioned before, if you are Gartner customers, you can go to Gartner Research Notes, which I wrote in the February-March 2005, when one of them is about different myths in the disaster recovery, and I am covering the distance. The thing is, I completely agree, and this was I was with the last speaker, and this was also what I was advising the customers in the United States. The first is the willing, the second is the possibility to move. If you look at what is happening in hurricanes and etc., the motorways are choked. The airplanes are not taking off. So even if they want to move, they cannot. So in general, what should be considered is what I normally say to customers in planning disaster recovery are several steps. The step number one is to perform business impact analysis, which will basically give idea what is the budget that you can use later on to invest in disaster recovery. The second one, perform risk impact analysis. When here the risk and the what the damage of each risk and what is the probability of this risk in your area. The third thing is the RPO, setting the RPO, and the last one is the NRO, which is network recovery objective. So when all this is set, then you can start to plan. But again, it's the very important are the first two.
So let me just make sure I got those. A business impact analysis, a risk impact analysis, and you said set the RPO, recovery point
objective. No, RPO, it doesn't matter here the sequence.
Okay,
RPO. This is negotiation with the business unit, because the normal scenario, if IT will go to business unit and will ask how much data am I allowed to lose, and how long can I be down, the answer is zero. And then you say, okay, we can do it, but it will cost you so much and so on. And then you start to negotiate until you reach logical RTO and logical RPO agreed with the business unit. They have to decide on that. It's not IT decision. IT is executing. It's
right.
A business decision.
Okay.
When you have the RTO and RPO, then you can decide which technology you use. You use synchronous, you use asynchronous, and et cetera.
Right, okay. And then the last one was the network recovery objective. So
network recovery objective, this is a technical, because in many cases, the recovery of the network, not the network, I'm not talking about the connection. I'm talking about network to external customer. Normally, recovery of the network takes longer time than any other recovery.
So we're going to have like a little checklist here, Josh, or a roadmap, and we'll start it on Wikibon and we'll attribute it to you because not everybody can afford those Gartner subscriptions. So we'll put that up and have you maybe fill it in if you like, but we'll, like I say, give you credit for that list. That's a good list, so thank you for sharing that with us. And then I guess we got to wrap here, folks. So I wonder if let me start with Hilton. Any closing thoughts or words of wisdom, advice for your peers that you give in this area?
I think the main thing is just, again, you know, working with the business, getting, although IT is meant to execute on their requirements, make sure that they themselves have thought through what that execution involves and that there's not a breakdown in communication there. That needs to be fully understood, I think. And the other thing as well is understanding that execution plan. There's always the point is that once you've pulled the trigger and you're going to invoke DR, you need to make sure that decision if you're making that decision, what is the impact? How do you go about sizing it and making it for various levels of disaster? The idea is if you have merely a data center or a row or a particular business area that you want to take to DR, having those things in place. And I think it's a lot more about the complexity around how you architect it within your firm. I think there's a lot of technologies that have, you know, come to the forefront and offered, but I think it's within the companies that are the politics and the architectural design from the business down through the execution that needs to be well defined.
Excellent. How about you, Steve? Any words of wisdom, peer advice?
Gosh, I suppose all I'd really say is if you absolutely want to guarantee an ability to recover, simplicity is the absolute key. Complexity at the point of recovery should always be regarded as massively more complex than during a test or normal operation, and ensure that the plan is practical from a human perspective, which I think for many of us in IT, we overly focus on the technology. I think we should look at the technology and draw it to a level where we say that as people, how could we operate it and use it, as opposed to assuming that the technology will solve our issue for us. It's really about making sure that people can work. So if the technology is simple and the technology is reliable, I think you have a far greater chance of recovery.
Excellent. Okay, Alex Winokur, we'll give you the last word.
Well, data recovery is a complicated issue. What can I say? And doing it synchronously from everything that I have seen simplifies a lot of things a lot. Consistency groups, long distances, setting the consistency group correctly, it's critical for asynchronous replication. It's much less so for synchronous one.
Okay, thank you. All right, folks, we have to wrap. On behalf of the Wikibon community, I'd really like to thank Hilton, Steve, Dr. Alex Winokur of Axana. Thank you very much for coming on the call today. It was really useful. I'd also like to thank the other Wikibon members who contributed to the call today, our good friend Josh Krischer. Excellent comments. Really, you really know this space well and appreciate you sharing your insights. David Floyer, John MacArthur, Mike Versace, and Julie Blanca, thanks for your questions and comments. As a reminder, our next Peer Insight is scheduled for Tuesday, May 25th, 2010, and the topic is Unified Storage, where we'll be joined by a practitioner from the College of St. Rose. As another reminder, over the next 24 hours or so, we'll have up on Wikibon 6 research notes pertaining to this call today with user actions, so look for those. And please feel free to hit the edit tab and improve the pieces, or put up your own piece, or even write a wiki tip. We'll also be producing a podcast of this call, and we'll be sending that out as well. Thanks for listening today, everybody, and thanks for being a Wikibon member. Bye for now.